How can we leverage the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic to create sustained long-term appreciation, funding, and workforce development related to the crucial nature of the public health infrastructure? Let's talk all about public health with Vanessa Lammers and Ron Bialik of the Public Health Foundation right here on episode 312 of The Nurse Keith Show. Hey there, this is Nurse Keith. In these days of the COVID-19 pandemic, you can still rely on my monthly pandemic updates at the end of each month. Meanwhile, this podcast continues to be all about you, your professional development, your nursing and healthcare career, and the healthcare system as a whole. And I'm here to share education, ideas, diatribes, and informative interviews with some of the most inspiring people from the worlds of healthcare, nursing, entrepreneurship, and beyond. I love having you along for the ride, whether you're new to the show or you've been on this journey with me for months or maybe even years. I thank you for being part of the growing Nurse Keith Nation. And remember that Nurse Keith Coaching is your destination for all things related to your nursing and healthcare career. I offer individualized, holistic career coaching for nurses and healthcare professionals around the world. And if you mention the show, you can get 10% off your first coaching package. So email me at keith@nursekeith.com. Okay, that's the shameless plug. And you might hear George the cat crying in the background. The show notes for this episode will be at nursekeith.com/episode in the number 312. And today we're joined by new friends of the pod, Vanessa Lammers and Ron Bialik of the Public Health Foundation. Thank you both for being here. And, you know, Vanessa, you and I met through, I think you replied to something I posted on Twitter, and then it became even more of a conversation. And then we brought Ron into this. We kind of coerced him into being on the podcast. And Ron, I'm going to throw the first question at you. And the question is, in these days of the pandemic, why is public health suddenly something everyone's talking about? And how can we keep them talking about it in the long term?
Well, Keith, first off, thank you so much for inviting both Vanessa and me. We appreciate being here. And it's a really good question because public health is not all that visible to folks. We don't have shiny red trucks with sirens and flashing lights. That's not what we have. But in public health, we have this opportunity with the pandemic where people, as you said, are talking about us. One of the problems, however, is what they're talking about and how they're talking about it. We've seen that our political leadership, our elected officials, are looking for folks to blame, are looking for folks to bash. Our public health officials are being harassed, are being fired, are being threatened violently for doing what their job requires them to do, which is to protect the public's health. So how do we turn this visibility into something positive? I think we can look at the fact that we've spent, gosh, now over $4 trillion that Congress has appropriated. We have lost, unfortunately, coming up to 400,000 lives before the end of this month. Millions of lives who've been disrupted. So trillions of dollars have been spent, lives have been lost, lives have been disrupted. So what the heck can we do to prevent this? If we had the public health infrastructure in place, if we had the political will and public will to fund public health only $4.5 billion per year, $13 per person, if we had that in place, we could have avoided some of the deaths, some of the disruption, and some of this enormous economic cost.
$13 per person, you're saying that that's what it would cost to fully fund the United States public health infrastructure. And that's, we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic here, but there's plenty of other things going on around public health. I mean, public health has brought you seatbelts and bike helmets and immunizations and disease eradication and tuberculosis management. I mean, we could list for an hour the things that public health has accomplished and continues to accomplish, right? So, Vanessa, from your point of view, how do we keep the conversation about public health going and have people recognize how important it is when we're not in the midst of a global crisis. Not that we don't always have global crises of some kind, but how do we keep this conversation going?
Yeah, hi, Keith, and thank you again for having both of us today. I think we have a real opportunity with COVID-19 because we've had, as a country and as a world, a unique shared experience that we can now build on to communicate with. So, you know, maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, where it would have been more difficult to maybe communicate about a public health program and the impacts of that program, we can use lessons learned from COVID to communicate public health challenges. So we can talk about the need to staff up contact tracing quickly and how we needed that. We can use that as a metaphor to talk about other public health programs, other crises that come along. We can talk a little bit about modernizing public health infrastructure through, you know, discussions about data management, right? At the beginning of the pandemic, there was so much information coming out at once about how many cases are in this city, how many cases are in this state. And we had such trouble tracking all of that. And I think collectively as a nation, we learned that our data infrastructure and our data reporting that feeds up from our hospitals and our locals and our states all the way to the federal government is really insufficient, not just for a pandemic atmosphere, but for all of our public health programs. And you, as somebody who's worked in public health yourself, knows firsthand how antiquated some of these systems are. So I think that's just one way we can use metaphors to kind of communicate. But I think we can really build from this shared experience as a communications tool to talk to our elected officials, explain what public health does and the benefits that it provides.
Wow, well said. You know, shared experience, that term says it all right there. And Ron, you just wanted to add something. What would you like to say to build on what Vanessa just said?
Well, a few weeks ago, I gave a presentation to a Rotary Club. Hmm. They asked me to come in and talk about public health because it was on their minds, which is a great thing.
That's great.
And during the presentation, I had a picture of a decrepit, poorly staffed, really unstaffed firehouse. And I said, so let's pretend for a moment that this is the firehouse that serves our community. No staff, broken down trucks, broken down building, and there's a fire. So now let's hire some firefighters. Let's get some trucks, and then let's fight the fire. Well, the fire's already done its damage. And that's precisely what we've seen with the pandemic. And we have to help people see that, to visualize that, to visualize what it's like to not have that system in place as we've had with the pandemic.
Wow. Okay. I love metaphors. You probably don't know that about me because we just met, but metaphors are my jam. So that's a really good one and I might steal it. I'll try to remember to credit you. So Ron, you're the CEO and the president of the Public Health Foundation, and you've been in those positions since 1997. And Vanessa, you're the assistant director of performance management and quality improvement at the Public Health Foundation. So I have to admit, the Public Health Foundation has crossed my radar several times, but it's not something I've had great understanding of until I came across Vanessa because she replied to something I posted on Twitter. And then I dove into it and all of a sudden I knew you all needed to be on the show as soon as possible. So Ron, for those of us out here who are ignorant about the Public Health Foundation, can you explain in a nutshell what it is and what its mission and purpose are?
Well, certainly. So our mission and purpose really is to improve the way that public health and population health is practiced so that that can result in healthier communities. And the way we go about doing that is really through organizational and individual development. So there's workforce development, training, hands-on technical support, how-tos, tools, resources. And we also do a lot of work in quality improvement and performance management. And that's focused on how do you do the best you possibly can with what you have? Mm-hmm. So So we hear all too often, you know, in public health agencies, people telling them, do more with less. You can't continue to do more with less. You can do the best you can, however, with what you have. And so that's really our focus.
I see. And in terms of quality improvement, Vanessa, what do you do specifically? Are you working directly with, like, I was a public health nurse in Amherst, Massachusetts during the H1N1 epidemic. So do you work directly with public health departments around the country, or are you working on kind of a larger scale?
A little bit of both. You may have, in the chaos of H1N1, seen some of our resources and tools come across your desk around that time related to quality improvement for H1N1 clinic flow, how to use the Plan, Do, Check, Act to assess what you're doing in real time rapidly. There was a lot of great information put out by PHF during the H1N1 days, as there is with COVID. I wasn't here during H1N1, so I can't take credit for any of it, but
we'll give you credit anyway.
A lot of great tools on the website. Same practices. I mean, if you're thinking about building a program, how do you build it from scratch? How do you develop it? How do you set metrics and measures? And then how do you evaluate that program? But most importantly, how do you continuously improve it through time? So if you're not reaching your public health outcomes, if you're not successfully, let's say, decreasing lead poisoning in your community, then how do you use quality improvement tools and methods to assure you reach your goals?
Ooh, okay. You just mentioned lead poisoning, and there were just indictments posted today. We're recording on January 15th, 2021, about the water supply in Flint, Michigan. So there is a public health issue for you. You know, generations of lead-based poisoning, or the reverberations of lead-based poisoning, and the educational and cognitive development deficiencies that we may see in students going forward for years to come. And we could look at the income loss or opportunity loss in those students because of I think there's decreases in IQ and achievement. So, you know, people think of public health as, you know, maybe, you know, immunizations, which we mentioned early on that immunizations is part of public health. But I mentioned seatbelts, I mentioned bike helmets. I mean, it goes from the very small at the very local level to the large global public health infrastructure, right? So Ron, where did we lose so many? I think you mentioned 30,000 positions have been lost in public health in the United States over the last 10 years, and funding, right? So why has this been lost when we've had so many different emergencies going on over the last 10 to 20 years? What's happened?
Good question.
Well, where do you begin?
Well, you know, let's begin with 9/11.
Okay, let's start there. Okay.
9/11, all of a sudden there was a realization that we needed to be better prepared. We need to have a better trained workforce. And all of a sudden there was an influx of funding.
Okay.
As Americans, we have short memories. Over time, the funding subsided. We had then our Great Recession. Mm-hmm. During the Great Recession, tremendous cuts to public health agencies. We've not recovered from that because those cuts occurred, and what crisis occurred afterwards? Not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Yes, we saw opioid problems occurring. We saw in some jurisdictions TB on the uprise, sexually transmitted diseases, but those weren't all that public other than opioids. And certainly there was some money around opioids.
Right. But we did have Ebola. We had SARS and MERS kind of, you know, emerging in different communities, nothing like we're seeing now, obviously. So there's been little, well, brush fires, if you will, where people have been like, oh boy, we'd better do something. But if we've lost 30,000 public health positions over 10 years, so, and this pandemic began, well, more or less 10 months ago, more or less. So we've been behind the eight ball since prior to this pandemic beginning, right?
Correct.
Okay. So how do we turn this around? And at the top of the episode, I asked, how can we leverage the impact of the pandemic to create interest and appreciation and funding for public health? What would the Public Health Foundation, and Ron, you're the CEO and president, what would you like to see happen? Let's just throw it out there.
Certainly, if we go back to, you know, the $4.5 billion, the $13 per person.
If we
had federal legislation that will be introduced, that is passed, that provides this level of funding, we will have the basic essential public health services that can be rebuilt and put in place. We can rebuild the workforce with that, and we can modernize data systems as well that are so important to what it is that we do. At the same time, we also need to have the political and public support. So with new leadership at the federal level, that should help us. But frankly, at the state level, there are a number of states that are really anti-government. And will new funding at the federal level for public health be then cut at the state level, you know, supplanted with the federal funding? So we really need public support. And I'll go back to the Rotary Club for just a moment. You know, they asked, what could they do? And I gave them a few things. Lead poisoning was one of the things that we talked about for social justice reasons.
Okay.
But I said, you know what? You can be supportive of your public health agency. You vote. You can send letters in. And also, by the way, because of all of the harassment of public health officials today, just write a letter to our local health officer and say thank you. Say thank you.
Or a letter to the editor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have that to has get the impact.
We have to get the public involved.
We do. And the public, now we have public health on the burner. Like, people realize public health's a thing. It's like, really? Wow. You know, and I've heard public health people say how, you know, it's kind of supposed to operate in the background. People aren't really supposed to see it. But I feel like that has changed, and it needs to remain changed, that it needs to be the new sexy thing, because not everybody, you know, granted, we have nurses slogging away in COVID units, and that's amazing. And that's a lot of my colleagues, but we also have public health officials and at the local, state and federal level and the global level slogging away as well. It's just a different type of slog, right? But it's just as important. It's just different. So Vanessa, you know, you work with state, local, tribal, and territorial health departments. Are you seeing that there are, how would I phrase this? What's the vast array of responses you've seen at those levels to the pandemic? And do you have any examples you'd like to use where some organization or locality is doing a really bang up, amazing job?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay. There are so many that are doing just an amazing job.
Good to hear.
At all levels. I think I have admired several of the health officials and government officials in Illinois and the way that they have communicated with the public during the pandemic, the way that they have used, you know, just plain language to try to lay it out for people, the way they've listened to people and understood where they're coming from and just, you know, connected with folks and said, hey, I know this is really, really hard. We're asking you again to stay home, or, you know, our hospitals are overloaded. I think we've seen that kind of leadership and those kind of excellent communication skills from across the country that have made a huge difference and have been able to sort of, you know, drill out of the political kind of polarization that we've kind of seen, that we've seen. I don't think I ever anticipated in January when this was coming down the pipeline that we were going to see public health really politically polarized in this way, or that we would in a pandemic. You know, thinking back, public health is always at the front about of every response. We're out there with the fire department, with FEMA. You know, we think about hurricanes and flooding and 9/11, mm-hmm. Zika, mm-hmm. Earthquakes across the country, any kind of disaster. You know, public health is right there, front and center, trying to get people what they need. So I didn't have an expectation that this would, you know, we'd end up having the communication challenges that we did. But I think the way that everyone sees public health right now, we've had so much interest. I think we can take this opportunity to leverage it. We have a whole new generation of people who are going to gravitate towards mm-hmm. the field of public health and healthcare. And so how are we going to capture these new students and this influx of people who are now going to want to go into infectious disease? And you know, how do we leverage all this interest? I should say also that health departments at every level have really suffered from what Ron was talking about with the loss of jobs over time, but also mm-hmm. they are just people who are also living through the pandemic, who are trying to juggle parenthood, school closures, taking care of elderly parents, being stuck at home over time, not being able to travel, not having time off, being burnt out, right? And they're at this point 10 months in and doing the best they can. And a lot of their colleagues have had to leave, just like we've seen losses in healthcare throughout the pandemic, because they just have too much on their plate and they're just too burnt out.
Yeah. So you mentioned Illinois, and I know like the Navajo Nation out here in the West has been hit really hard, the Diné people, as they call themselves. And I know there's several tribal nations that have done a great job. They've really been on top of this. So that could be a whole conversation about the divvying up of money and the various reservations and tribes who have a lot of money or don't. There's 16 Native American Pueblos reservations here in northern New Mexico in three different language groups. So we've got a lot going on here in northern New Mexico alone. So, I mean, we can go from the smallest little town in Oklahoma with a one-person public health department, perhaps, to a very large infrastructure, let's say in Illinois, right, or California. And then we have the global part that we need to look at. So when we come back from the break, I want to kind of expand the view to the global outlook around public health. And then I always like to talk about solutions too. And I'd like to reflect on what you just shared, Vanessa, about bringing people into the public health fold. And so we're going to talk about how to recruit people in and make public health super cool. So we'll be right back with the second half of episode 312 of the Nurse Keith Show. So now we're going to take a pause for the cause for just a moment. Please consider becoming a patron of the Nurse Keith Show, just like other awesome listeners who value the show so much that they want to give just a little bit each month to support the work we're doing here. When you pledge, you not only get the satisfaction of helping produce and support the Nurse Keith Show, you also get some pretty cool premiums and gifts from yours truly. Just head over to patreon.com/nursekeith to read all about it. That's patreon.com/nursekeith. And if you know someone who could benefit from career coaching with me, please consider referring them. And if they become a paying client, you'll receive credit for an hour of coaching with me, and there's no expiration date on that credit, so you can keep it in your back pocket until you need it most. And remember that you can refer as many people as you like and continue to earn those coaching credits. What an incredible deal! And please head over to nursekeith.com and sign up for my newsletter, which comes out regularly and brings you supportive messages, updates from my blog and my podcast, resources, and all sorts of other stuff. Remember, nursekeith.com, sign up for that newsletter, and you'll also get a free download from me as my gift to you. Anyway, those are my sincere asks today. So now, let's dig back into today's topic without further ado. And welcome back to the second half of the episode. Remember the show notes to learn all about Ron Bialik, Vanessa Lammers, and the Public Health Foundation will be at nursekeith.com/episode and the number 312. So again, oh boy, there's so much to unpack here. And Vanessa, you were just talking before the break about the need to capture students and even current healthcare professionals to bring them into public health. And I was a public health nurse for just over a year, like I said, in Amherst, Mass. It was a town of 25,000. And it was a fascinating position. It was really fascinating. And H1N1 gave me a little trial by fire, I guess you could say. So I don't have a public health degree. I've met a number of physicians and nurses who do have public health degrees. So what is the value, for instance, Vanessa, of marketing, for lack of a better term, what it would mean to get an MPH for someone who is a nurse or is a physician? So how do we tell them, like, getting an MPH could be really cool because you could be involved in blank? So how would you approach that particular calculus?
As someone with an MPH, I think I get this question a lot, right? Like, why did you go and get one? You know, what value has that brought to your life?
Right.
And the nice thing about an MPH is that it is a degree that's sort of understood. You know, you get an MPH from any public health institution across the country, and it's very similar in the types of knowledge and skills that you come out with. And we work a lot with...
Right. But yours happens to be from Yale, I'll just say.
we work a lot with the accrediting... Thanks, Keith. Appreciate you. We work a lot with the accrediting bodies that kind of oversee, you know, what these programs look like. And of course, one of PHF's flagship resources is the development of the core competencies between public health professionals through the Council on Linkages Between Academia and Public Health Practice. We're very involved in these connections and these conversations already. And I think, you know, having people who work in healthcare, folks who have been on the front lines in medicine, they see what they can control in the clinic environment. And they see firsthand that so much of the work that they do could have been, you know, situations could have been prevented, and that there's so much upstream that can be done at the programmatic level and even at the individual health education level that's just really difficult to grasp in a clinic or hospital environment. And so that's why we get these amazing public health nurses who have these dual skill sets of sort of clinical expertise and also public health and prevention expertise. I think we drastically need those skill sets in public health because we have to bridge those connections with our healthcare communities. And I should say that we know there are so many public health schools and students every year. I think we're graduating the students, but we need to recruit them into public health. A lot of them end up in other industries because of recruitment and retention issues with our public health.
Right. And if 30,000 jobs have been cut in the last 10 years, there you go, right?
Exactly.
So we can lose people, they hemorrhage off to other areas because those areas have the money, they have the funding, they have the marketing, and they're like, oh, come work with us. So, you know, there's so many ways, and this is a whole nother conversation, I'm just going to say this, that in education, where we have physicians being educated in a silo, physical therapists being educated in a silo, social workers, nurses, if we can have more cross-pollination and dual courses where physicians and social workers and nurses and public health students study together in the same class, and we get them all seeing each other and seeing, oh, wow, there's this other silo, and it doesn't have to be a silo. It could actually be this open space for me to hang out in. So I don't think there's a lot of nursing programs where they talk about public health very much, most likely, or maybe they are now. And if you're listening out there and you want to correct me on that, please feel free. But, you know, I'd like them to talk more than about working in the hospital in acute care. You know, there's plenty of other things to do. You know, why isn't public health something that is brought even more robustly into medical and nursing education competencies? And that we could do a whole episode on that, right, Vanessa?
We absolutely could, especially if we bring in Kathleen and others from PHF who do a lot of focus almost all their time on this.
Well, let's do that another time.
Absolutely. I should say that Ron, though, does lend his time to the Johns Hopkins University nursing program and does frequent lectures for them that talk to... It's the master's level nursing program, right, Ron?
It's a joint MPH-MSN program.
Very
special.
MPH-MSN. I have heard of those programs. So that's at Johns Hopkins University specifically.
Correct. And unfortunately, I believe they are ending that program and focusing on the doctoral level, even though I keep saying we need the practice people. Yes, we need the researchers, but we need the practice people.
Right. We need people who are boots on the ground in a public health office. Okay. Well, let's call Johns Hopkins.
That breaks my heart.
Yeah. Let's call them up. Okay. You know, let's get them on the line.
And Keith, if I may, to follow up on what you were saying about sort of this cross-pollination, that is a vision that we've had for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we're going to work towards moving forward because we have I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called the Train Learning Network, and it's just train.org. Mm-hmm. And there are about 3 million users worldwide. And about 1 million of the users are healthcare. Hmm. About 300,000 are governmental public health. And then there's preparedness. And then there are other sectors there. Well, what a unique opportunity for us to provide some training that cuts across the sectors. And so we would like to figure out a way to capture that and to really develop some of the training or develop training plans, whatever it may be, that would enable those from those different perspectives and different professions to be taking training that is similar. Mm-hmm. So that even if we don't end up with the 1 million healthcare providers going into public health, if they develop a public health perspective, if they develop some of the knowledge and expertise in that area, then they're practicing public health in a hospital setting, in a clinic setting, in other settings. And that's what we really need to do is spread where public health is practiced.
Right. And that public health perspective can incorporate all sorts of notions and concepts and things going on in our country, or if you're in another country, we can look at food deserts and we can look at socioeconomics and we can look at violence. I mean, gun safety is a public health issue. So it's not just immunizations and infections and STIs and pandemics. I mean, there's a certain lens we can wear in public health that when we're a practicing medical provider, we can look at a patient in that context. We can look at them from a different lens and see them in the context of this bigger infrastructure or lack thereof. And having done the work I've done in the community, I've been aware of food deserts and all sorts of urban and rural issues. And even internet access we could see as a public health issue if we really want to extrapolate it out, right?
Absolutely.
If we don't have access to information. And that might sound like a stretch to some listeners that internet access is a public health issue, but we can think about that. And Vanessa, you reacted to that right away. So is it...
Absolutely.
So let's take internet access just as an example. So how does a lack of internet access impact public health out there in the, let's just say in the United States? What happens?
I think personally about all of the information and access to information that I've had as somebody who has always had a really excellent internet connection, especially as I've gotten into school and graduate education. I can't imagine completing a graduate education without strong internet and access to international libraries and journals. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly difficult. And yet we ask people to do that across the country every day in a pandemic somehow. Mm-hmm. And I think about just health education in general, the information as a parent raising a child to be able to access basic information, talk to a pediatrician, and then have a telehealth visit. Even before COVID-19, there was a need for infrastructure and telehealth infrastructure across the country. And we've just seen the importance of that grow, you know.
Good point.
100,000-fold.
Great point. Right. So telehealth is directly connected to having connectivity to the internet, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So Ron, if let's say I'm a nurse out there in the world, maybe I've been working in a clinical space for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. And, you know, I'm aware of socioeconomics. I'm aware of the issue Vanessa and I were just talking about. You know, I have this kind of, those concepts are in my mind. And I look at my patients and I think, huh, you know, look at all these things impacting them. So if I want to look at public health as a career track, or maybe just a, like maybe I have, there's something I can get involved in around public health. What are some of the steps I can take to explore what that might mean and how I might go about making that part of my career?
Well, there are initially, I mean, some websites you could go to. Our website, of course, mm-hmm. But the National Association of County and City Health Officials.
Oh, yes.
The Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, where there's a lot of information about what public health is doing. So for one, you might want to know, how could I, you know, are these governmental agencies actually doing anything? And mm-hmm. you'll be really impressed that they are doing a tremendous amount. And then it's talking to somebody even in your local health department, mm-hmm. about it. Talking to people like me. Mm-hmm. I'm always receptive. One of the things that we do at PHF is we've had interns. Thank you, Vanessa. Vanessa's been leading up our internship program.
Great.
And one of the best ways to get somebody interested in public health is for them to have a positive experience in an internship. And we stress that with our colleagues in the field. We do that ourselves. We have something called the Academic Health Department Learning Community. Mm-hmm. And that's for creating these bridges between academia and public health practice and get students early on having a positive experience so that they say, hey, wow, I never thought about this. This mm-hmm. is what I want to do. And there's tremendous success with that. So there are multiple ways. I wouldn't say necessarily the best place to start is to knock on the door of the university, because you okay. might get the perspective of an academic public health approach versus boots on the ground.
I see. So you would start locally and first see what's happening in your area, look at some of these foundations and organizations that are involved in public health on a state or regional level, and then maybe start to explore what your, higher education options might be, right?
Yes. But Vanessa?
Okay.
I would love to add, I know we talked about an MPH, but I've worked with a lot of public health nurses and a lot of extremely talented nurses who work in public health, and very few of them have had an MPH. I don't think it's a requirement at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of extremely talented people in public health don't have an MPH in general. I think there's a...
Thank you, Vanessa.
Ron has an MPP. So,
right, you have a master's in public policy.
Yeah. So I think health departments have a lot to offer nurses in general. You know, I think there's a lot of consistency in hours. granted, right now is a pandemic. I know a lot of people are working 80-hour weeks. That's not necessarily the case, right? If you are a nurse who wants a schedule that's a little more predictable or looking for daytime hours, you want to work for a mission-based organization that's improving the public's health. There's a lot to be said for working for a public health department, a particular local public health department. And I know the National Association of County and Health, County and City Health Officials often lists a lot of those jobs in their career centers as well.
Yeah, I was happy to do that. I was the lone public health nurse in my town, and it was really fun. I loved doing what I did. And we had a very small department, but we partnered with the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. They had their own public health nurse. So between that campus and the town, we had about 55,000 people or 50,000 people. So it was very, very interesting. And we had the Medical Reserve Corps. I actually headed up our local Medical Reserve Corps as part of that job. So there was a lot of moving parts, and there was a lot to learn. And so there's, you know, you can work in public health without the degree, which I proved, and you could move in the direction of research and policy, or you could move in the direction of actually like working in a department or working at the tribal level or whatever areas we want. So we need people at every juncture getting involved. So the Public Health Foundation is an organization where people can turn for education. Can a nursing school, like say the dean of a nursing school, because I do have educators and academics listening to the show, can they contact the Public Foundation and say, hey, we would like to somehow bring some public health perspective into our program? Are you a good place to do that?
Absolutely. Through a variety of ways. One is, you know, now there's a lot of remote work done with internships. So there's a way of bringing students in to work with us. In addition, if one were to look at training, that's the training on train is free for anybody to sign up for. And a nursing program, if they wanted to expose some of the students to public health courses, there are several one could choose from that and integrate it into their own curriculum. We actually did this a few years ago with a couple of HBCUs because we were looking at how can we better diversify the workforce.
And, HBCUs?
Oh, sorry. Historically Black colleges and universities.
Oh, right. Yes.
Right. And we were looking at ways to diversify the workforce. So we worked with some of those institutions and came up with a intro to public health training plan just from trainings and train that others developed, put them together, and then they were provided to undergraduate students.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
And a number of those undergraduate students ended up going on to public health careers.
That's great. And it's train.org, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, I know that you're a member of the National Quality Forum, NQF, Prevention and Population Health Standing Committee, and you served on their expert panel on food insecurity and housing instability. And then there was a book that came out in 2017, Solving Population Health Problems Through Collaboration, right? So yes. Does the Public Health Foundation have its own publishing arm, and are both of you involved in writing articles or coming up with competencies? So Vanessa, are you part of that arm of the PHF? Do you do that sort of thing as well?
PHF does have a learning resource center, and I think we all work sort of collaboratively on that, but I'll let Ron take the book and publishing question.
Okay.
Well, but I will say, so, you know, We all try to write as much as we can and push information out. So we have our Public Health Foundation e-news. Vanessa recently did a blog publication online with the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice to push information out. And then, you know, books, the books that we've developed have been published by others.
Great.
So we don't have a publishing arm per se.
I see.
But then we make them available
Great. And I'm just going to say it, just going to put it out there, that I do think that a podcast from the PHF would be a very powerful forum. And it could reach people who don't have time to read articles and don't have time to go through all the books. And it's something people can take with them wherever they go. And it's a very strong way of reaching people and getting right between their ears these days. And if you guys could launch a podcast, get it out there in the world, we can get you on the Health Podcast Network along with Sanjay Gupta and the New England Journal of Medicine and the Mayo Clinic's podcast, and get this message out further and have more healthcare professionals and lay people hear, you know, what, how cool public health is and how many things we can accomplish and how important it is. And I think at the beginning of our conversation before we hit record, I was saying how I was listening to one of Sanjay Gupta's most recent episodes on his Coronavirus Fact versus Fiction podcast from CNN. And Sanjay was talking with someone who'd been working in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And they have a very robust infrastructure there, and they're looking at zoonotic illnesses. And they're saying that there's more coming. And yes, we've lost 400,000 people here in the US, and Great Britain's lost more than they lost in World War II. And hopefully we won't have another pandemic like this for a very long time, but we need to be prepared, don't we? And the more we can get the public to realize how important public health is and the government, then you all can do your work and spread the gospel of public health. So, you know, Ron, what would be your last word about what citizens can do to, let's say, look at public policy and legislation? Do we talk to our representatives? What do we do to say, hey, this is actually really important to me?
I'd say just don't forget. Don't forget how important this is. And yes, sending letters to legislators, meeting with them. I mean, virtually every congressional representative has offices locally.
They do.
But it's also quite important to get to the state level.
Okay.
There's a lot of decisions about public health and what public health agencies can do that are directed by state government and by local government, and write to your local legislators. They have town halls. Meet with them.
Yeah. Good point. And here in New Mexico, I find a lot of our state legislators are very, very accessible. And we can walk right into what we call the roundhouse here in Santa Fe and talk to them. Not right now, not during the pandemic, but, you know, off season when we're not in legislative session and not in a pandemic, there are legislators here who, you know, they'll meet you for coffee if you want to sit down and have a conversation. So that can be done. So Vanessa, how about you? What are some actions people can take as professionals or as citizens? Is there something else you would recommend?
Those were great recommendations from Ron. We can always meet with and talk with our representatives, and especially our local city council, our, you know, local government that we elect, local board of education. Hmm. Often those people shape our lives so much. We should definitely know their names. Hmm. And I think for your audience, for a lot of nurses in particular, the city councilmen and legislators really want to hear from healthcare personnel right now. They really want to understand the experience of nurses and frontline healthcare personnel of all kinds, and would be really receptive to hearing your stories. I think my only other tidbit that I have to add is, please get your COVID-19 flu shot, COVID-19 vaccine when that has become available. There's a lot of
yes, please.
Great free trainings that have just become available at train.org if you want to learn more about the mRNA process or have any questions whatsoever. It is completely okay to have questions about new vaccines as they come out, but I would strongly end by encouraging all of our healthcare personnel to get protected for them, for their own health.
Thank you. And the reports of how many healthcare professionals don't want the vaccine are very disturbing. And hopefully, you know, as time goes on, they're going to become more comfortable with that, because we need to set examples for the rest of our communities too. So I know people can find you at phf.org, which is very simple. And you're also on Facebook, and it's PHFDC, right, on Facebook?
Yes.
And then on Twitter, it's the PHF. And then there's also, you can find both of you on LinkedIn. We'll have all the links at the show notes. And I want to thank you both for being here. And I'd like to bring some of your other staff members onto the show, maybe mid or later in the year. We can have another conversation and go deeper and kind of address some of these other public health issues that we touched on. But, you know, we need more voices and more time to talk about it. And then we'll launch your podcast and that'll be history. So thank you so much for being here. You all are wonderful. And we're going to really do a lot of publicizing of what the good work that PHF does.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, we really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nurse Keith Show. Remember to learn all about the Public Health Foundation and Vanessa Lammers and Ron Bialik. Go to nursekeith.com/episode312. I hope you feel uplifted and empowered from this episode, and I encourage you to take inspired and informed action every day in the interest of your personal professional satisfaction, and consider how you can contribute to the greater good. Did you know there are job listings and other resources at nursekeith.com? Head over to nursekeith.com to the resources drop-down menu to find jobs from Reload, Trusted Health, Incredible Health, ZipRecruiter, and lots of other resources for you. The Nurse Keith Show is a member of Ars Longa Media, a collaborative network of podcasts and media entities dedicated to partnering to improve social ills. We are at Ars Longa, that's ARSLONGA.media. We're also a member of the Health Podcast Network, along with the Mayo Clinic's podcast, Penn Nursing, Dr. Sanjay Gupta's podcast, and many, many others. Find us at healthpodcastnetwork.com. The Nurse Keith Show is adroitly produced by Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting, and Mark Cappy Speeson is our stalwart social media ringmaster. I'm grateful to both Rob and Mark for keeping the wheels turning in the right direction. Be well, dig deep, seek joy, keep in touch. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico. Vanessa Lammers bidding you adieu from
Silver Spring, Maryland.
Silver Spring. And Ron Bialik saying adios from
Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Chevy Chase, Maryland. Okay, thank you both so much. And we will catch everybody on the flip side.